Well, so thank you to the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. So the title of my talk is What is the Simplicity of the Early Universe Trying to Tell Us? And basically, in short, I want to tell you about a new picture of the early universe that I've been working on primarily with Neil Turek and other collaborators over the past few years, and try to sketch some of the reasons we're excited about it. You know, these are the papers that I'll be trying to sketch something of what they're about here. You see they're mostly with Neil here, but the first two are also with Kieran Finn, who was my former master's student here. Very briefly, the idea or the spirit is to try to take very seriously the standard model of particle physics, try to take very seriously the solutions of the Einstein equations, and... Oh, maybe so. Okay. Thank you. The solutions of the Einstein equations. This feels weird. And their analytic extensions, and in particular, you know, if the analytic extensions have interesting extra, you know, if you analytically extend the solution and notice that it has extra symmetries or extra complex analytic properties, meromorphic properties that you didn't notice before, rather than discarding that as a mathematical artifact, take that seriously as a possible hint about what's going on. And it's been exciting that it seems to us that you managed to get kind of what seemed to us like kind of rigid and elegant new explanations for a surprisingly large number of things. So I just want to take through a sketch of some of those things. So let's dive in. Okay, so this is my cartoon picture of the expanding universe. So the conformal time is moving up the page, and this inverted lampshade is supposed to be the universe sort of expanding as it gets older. And so you and I are living up here at the top of the lampshade sort of long after the Big Bang. And we look back with our telescopes, but you can't see all the way back to the Big Bang. Your view is obstructed because the universe gets too dense. But you can see a long way back, and in fact, observationally, it's what we see when we look back is that as far back as we can see, which is, you know, directly back to a few hundred thousand years, but more indirectly back to a fraction of a second, the early universe was very different than the universe today. And in particular, there's this very striking trend that as you look back, the further back you look, the simpler things get. So that at a fraction of a second after the bang, the universe was incredibly simple. It was sort of simple in every way you could imagine. So that, first of all, to a first approximation, the background metric and the background sort of average density was, if you imagine taking a three-dimensional snapshot at some moment, it was maximally symmetric. It was basically just a copy of three-dimensional Euclidean space filled by a uniform matter distribution. And then there are tiny deviations from that of order 10 to the minus 5, and they seem to be also as simple as could be. They seem to be completely random. Their statistics seems to be the simplest things you could imagine. They seem to be purely scalar, aka density perturbations. And the statistics of these random fluctuations is also as simple as you could imagine. It shares the maximal it's the statistically symmetric with a distribution that's also maximally symmetric, just like the background. And moreover, as far as we can tell so far, it seems to be perfectly Gaussian, perfectly adiabatic. Since it's Gaussian, the statistics is completely characterized by the two-point function of the perturbations.
Sorry, what do you mean when you say it's adiabatic?
Adiabatic is a cosmology term. Sorry, that means that there's only one independent mode in the perturbations, as if that all the different perturbations and all the different parts of the fluid are correlated. So for example, the radiation density and the matter density are all correlated in such a way that it looks like if there's a density perturbation, if the universe is a little bit under-dense in some region, it's exactly as though the universe in that region had lived a little bit longer since the Big Bang than neighboring regions. Which tells you certain fractions between the...
And which observation tells you that?
So the cosmic microwave background, the fitting of the peaks of the cosmic microwave background is an example of something where if people put limits on so-called isocurvature perturbations, which are deviations from the various possible deviations from, yeah. Okay, so so they seem, the two-point function seems to be described by a pure power law. It's a nearly scale invariant power law at that. And moreover, the perturbations seem to have become synchronized as you follow them back to the Big Bang. So if you follow any given, the amplitude of any given Fourier mode of the density field or the curvature perturbation as you follow it back to the Big Bang, you know, it seems to have approached a constant as you got back to the Big Bang, as exactly as if the Big Bang was a mirror surface that was applying a where there was a Neumann boundary condition being imposed. So there's all this striking stuff, all this striking simplicity about the early universe, and that clearly is sort of the key hint in early universe cosmology. It's the fundamental thing, fundamental hint, and the question is, what is it trying to tell us? You know, the usual, the sort of conventional interpretation is that the conventional interpretation is that, that trend, the fact that as you go back towards the Big Bang, as far back as you can see, things get simpler and simpler. The usual idea is that that's a mirage, that if you could see back even further, things would get complicated again. And there would be a big mess at even earlier times that you can't see. And then the idea is you invoke some cosmological epoch. The most popular thing is inflation, which is supposed to sort of somehow through its dynamics smooth out the mess and produce the simple initial state that you actually see. And so I just want to try to follow a different direction, line of thought. You know, I want to sort of just try to take the observed trend, the fact that as far back as we can see, things seem in a very striking way to be getting simpler until you get very close to the Big Bang. I want to try to take that at face value. Maybe that's really what the observations are trying to tell us. Maybe for some reason, things really do just get very simple as you go back to the Big Bang, and the Big Bang was, for some reason, a very simple surface. So let's try to follow that line of thought and see where it leads. Okay, so you know, if that's the case, as a first helpful thing, it'll be helpful to use Penrose's famous trick from the 60s of conformally rescaling the space-time stretching it in a way that preserves all the angles locally so that just to make the sort of causal structure near the boundaries and near the singularities clearer. So that's what I've done here. I've just taken that previous lampshade and stretched it into a straight cylinder, but it's the same basic picture. I'm just drawing it differently. And so this again is us up here, and this is as far back as we can look. So if things really are as simple as they seem, then we know what the metric is like back at early times. It's to a very good approximation, just the actual metric is just the flat Minkowski metric, completely regular, and then times a conformal factor, the scale factor. And then there is a singularity if you follow the conformal factor back a little bit beyond what you can see, but it's this very special kind of singularity, very atypical, where the rest of the metric remains very regular, but just the conformal factor in front momentarily passes through zero. And moreover, it does so in a very simple and analytic fashion. It just has a simple zero as a function of the conformal time. And so unlike a normal singularity in GR, here there's no ambiguity about how to analytically extend through this one. The analytic extension is just obtained by allowing, not stopping tau at zero, just letting it become negative. So if you do that, you get this sort of extended doubled cylinder with a part below tau equals zero. And the interesting thing you notice when you look at this extended cylinder is that it has a new symmetry that you didn't notice when you were just looking at the upper half, a new isometry under tau goes to minus tau, basically that it's symmetric under flipping the sort of two halves of the hourglass here. And that's interesting because an FRW spacetime with that extra symmetry has a preferred vacuum state for the quantum fields living on it, the so-called CPT symmetric vacuum state. So, you know, we're used to in Minkowski space, there's enough symmetry that there's a unique vacuum state of a quantum field living on that space-time that respects all that symmetry, full Poincaré invariance. in a general curve spacetime, that's no longer the case. There's famously an ambiguity about what the vacuum state is. So different observers, for example, in different states of motion or different parts of the spacetime will in general disagree about what the state of zero particles is. And in FRW spacetimes, cosmological spacetimes, that's also the case. But it's almost not. There's almost enough symmetry in FRW. FRW plus this time reversal symmetry does have enough symmetry to pick out a sort of best vacuum. Okay, so let's try to take that first hint seriously and try to imagine maybe you know, CPT is thought to be this very fundamental symmetry of the laws of nature, but it sort of seems, when you're just looking at the top half of that space-time, to be sort of spontaneously broken by the state of the universe. But okay, now we look at the extended state and notice no, maybe not. So let's try to assume that CPT is not broken. Take that hint and see where that leads.
Will you say more about the preferred vacuum? You just use the
on the next slide. I will. Yeah.
What you said so far is independent of the form of A of tau, or what?
So I'm assuming that it's really the I think the statement about picking a preferred vacuum, all you need is that A of tau is odd, is an odd function.
Okay.
If the universe is radiation dominated early time. So I think that's really the statement that I'm assuming here, yeah. Okay, so in answer to your question, Ted, so what do I mean by this vacuum state? Well, here briefly is the idea. So let's consider a field living on the space-time. So for example, a spinner field here, psi of x. So the usual way that you, or one way to quantize that in curved space-time is you split that into a basis of solutions of the equation of motion, the Dirac equation in this case. And you split that basis of solutions into two parts. The positive frequency solutions, the ones that rotate this way in the complex plane over any point in space, and the negative frequency solutions, the charge conjugate solutions that rotate the opposite way. And then you quantize by promoting the Fourier coefficients in front of the positive frequency solutions to they become the annihilation operators of the particle associated with that field, and the corresponding coefficients in front of the charge conjugate solution become the creation operators of the corresponding antiparticle of that field. And okay, so the issue that I mentioned on the previous slide shows its face in this approach due to the fact that, you know, when I want to split the solution, when I want to split my basis of solutions into positive and negative frequency, well, again, there's no ambiguity about how to do that in flat space, in the sense that all inertial observers agree about that split. But in a general curve space, the issue is that people at different points in the space-time won't agree about how to split the solution into positive and negative frequency. And so, for example, you know, we up here in the room here, we would call certain solutions positive frequency at late times and certain other frequencies negative frequency. And so we called our positive frequency solutions psi plus here, and the coefficients that we put into the above expansion, A plus, we would call A plus and B plus. And the state annihilated by those coefficients would be our vacuum state, zero plus. That's what we would call no particles in the room here. On the other hand, again, in FRW, you know, another observer here down, you know, for large negative tau, they would define a different set of frequency, a different set of solutions would look positive frequency down here. And so they would do a different split, and their coefficients, A minus and B minus, would annihilate a different state in the Hilbert space. So that would be their vacuum state, zero minus. But those two states are inequivalent, and they're exchanged by CPT. And so neither of them is CPT invariant. But there is another choice you can make, which is to take your mode functions to satisfy this extra condition. When the background solution is symmetric, has this extra isometry, you can take the solutions to satisfy this extra condition that the mode function, the positive frequency mode at time tau, is equal to the charge conjugate mode at time minus tau, and then you find that the resulting vacuum state in that case, when you split the modes that way, has this extra symmetry.
The geometry has a kink, right, at t equals zero?
Yes.
So
the mode functions are all the background and the mode functions are all analytic there. But it's absolutely true. There's the Big Bang. I mean, there's a singularity there. It doesn't obstruct doing this calculation or anything because the Dirac equation is perfectly.
It seems like a very idealized picture where you have a geometry and then you have free fields on the background of it. I would think at the kink, you know, the curvature is infinite and you should be doing quantum gravity.
That's a good, very, very, very good, very good point. So there's a couple things to say about that. So first of all, it is like let me just make it clear that there is some big assumption in taking seriously the analytic extension of the solution once you do that, there's much less of an assumption then it's not really so much of an assumption to analytically extend this field, because the field we're actually going to apply this for is a completely free field, the right-handed neutrino. I'll get to that in a moment. But two things to say are that, first of all, I'll get to this later, but, you know, we think that fundamentally that the laws of nature are vial invariant. We want to argue for that later on, and if that's so, this is kind of it makes the Big Bang a nicer singularity because it's a purely vial singularity. It's just a it becomes more analogous to the black hole horizon, which, if diff invariance is really a good symmetry of the theory, you realize the black hole horizon is not really a singularity, it's just a coordinate singularity. It's a bit analogous. If vial invariance is really a good symmetry of the theory, then the Big Bang is just a moment where where the metric is purely regular except for the vial factor going through zero. But if that can be removed by a vial transformation, well, it can't quite, because there's a topological thing, because the conformal factor is switching signs there. But nevertheless, it's a kind of topological kink, like you say. It makes it seem a lot more nice to deal with, a lot less scary than it's usually imagined in the absence of conformal symmetry. But then the other thing to say is that, in terms of these analytic extensions, you know, you can all the action that I'll be talking about will using this vacuum state. I'm about to say how this vacuum state gives a nice explanation for what the dark matter is, but that whole argument relies on, you can analytically extend this function in the complex plane and then follow it in the complex tau plane in a large circle that goes around tau equals zero, never gets close to tau equals zero, so stays in the low curvature regime. And all of the Bogle-Yubov transformation that gets built up that differentiates this vacuum for the late time vacuum, which is what you need to sort of calculate the, that all accumulates at a time not at the Big Bang. It accumulates at the moment after the Big Bang, when the universe was as old as one Compton oscillation of the dark matter particle, which is way below the Planck scale. It's down in the non-quantum gravity regime. So we think it just depends on kind of taking seriously the analyticity and symmetry of the solution way below the Big Bang, except for this huge assumption that you really even take seriously the analytic extension of the solution at all, into the including past the pole at tau equals zero. Tau equals zero is a pole, basically, and you have to go around it.
That's it.
Yeah.
For vial invariance, the particles have to be massless.
If it's not spontaneously broken. I know you know this, John. You wrote a good paper I read about this. Yes, Carla.
It's a comment. You can approximate the geometry, the background geometry you're considering, arbitrarily well with a regular metric.
You can say this again. You can approximate
the geometry you're considering arbitrarily well with a regular metric where the curvature doesn't diverge, where A, instead of doing that, is a little bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I suppose it would go the same symmetry argument.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. So indeed. So there is a subtle difference between whether A is an even function of tau and whether A is an odd function of tau.
With an odd function, it just doesn't go.
No, I think you're thinking about an even function of tau.
Sorry?
An odd function has to go through zero in the middle, because you know it's symmetric under tau goes to minus tau, and if A goes to minus A when tau goes to minus tau, then by continuity it has to have a zero in the middle.
Yes, but in the metric, what I'm saying is that the metric A never comes in, only A squared comes in.
But still, if A goes through zero, then A squared also goes through zero. So A squared is always even, but there is this distinction between whether A is even.
I stick on my point. If you just change coordinate from tau to tau squared, and then you can show you the details. But you can approximate arbitrarily well your geometry.
Mm-hmm.
Geometry, the sign of A never comes in. Is A squared?
I agree it's a very subtle, you know, the issue is that fermions don't couple to the metric, they couple to the tetrad, and the tetrad is the square root of the metric, so the tetrad really depends on A. So how the tetrad is related between the two sheets really depends, if you really want to be careful about what spinners are doing on the spacetime.
Oh, I see. So you don't want just the metric. I was talking about the Riemannian.
The metric, I agree. Only thing that appears there is A squared. And so at the level, so if there were no spinners in the world, you sort of wouldn't maybe care about the difference between
the triad with the tetrad. I see.
But so again, we think that it's a kind of important. I can maybe discuss afterwards. I tend
do the same as a scalar field instead of a Dirac.
You can. Let's talk about it afterwards. I think there's a very interesting thing that if you think about the tetrad as the soldering form that relates, you know, the tangent bundle over spacetime to like Cartan's other vector bundle.
It has to flip. I agree.
Yeah. That basically it's saying those two vector bundles, which you usually assume are maybe topologically the same in the K theory sense, maybe they're actually two different topological bundles, and so it's forced to have they both could separately be completely regular smooth bundles, but if they have different topology, then the map between them has to have a singularity at some point, and maybe that's what the Big Bang is. But if that's true, then you know you're not going to smooth out great. So now I want to sketch that this gives a nice explanation for what the dark matter might be, because it's very analogous to Hawking radiation. In Hawking radiation, you know, the black hole is really in one state, but because the space-time is curved, an observer far away from the black hole defines a different vacuum state, and so it looks to them like there's a non-zero density of particles coming away from the black hole. So analogously, I want to say maybe the universe is really in this CPT symmetric state, but we at late times define a different vacuum state. And because those are related by a non-trivial so-called Bogoliubov transformation, you can calculate, although I'm not going to show the calculation here, that you know, it looks to us like there is a flux of particles emerging from the early universe. And in particular, I want to argue that one of those gives a nice dark matter candidate. So here, let's briefly review what's in the standard model of particle physics. So here on the top line are the bosons. These are the three different types of gauge bosons associated with SU3, SU2, and U1. And here's the Higgs doublet. And then there's the fermions. So there's three different colors of quarks and three leptons in each generation. And in the sort of traditional, original version of the standard model, those 15 fermions per generation is all there was. And then there were three copies of these generations. Sorry, that was a three. That whole structure gets multiplied by three for some reason. So if that's all there is in the standard model, there's just no dark matter candidate left in that model. There's nobody that's stable and hasn't been directly detected yet. But, you know, ever since the late 90s and the confirmation of neutrino oscillations, it seems like the best renormalizable explanation for that is to add a right-handed neutrino to every generation, which very neatly completes a bunch of beautiful patterns in the standard model and also gives a very good account of the observed neutrino oscillations and neutrino masses. Now if you have this extended model, now there is exactly one potential dark matter candidate. There's exactly one of these particles now that still can be exactly stable and that we haven't detected yet, which is one of these three right-handed neutrinos. So I want to use that as the dark matter candidate. It turns out if you just take the Lagrangian to be symmetric under that, neutrino goes to minus itself. It completely kills all of its decay modes. It completely cuts it off from the rest of the standard model. So the same symmetry that makes it stable makes it completely dark, coupled to nothing but gravity. So that's the good news. The bad news, then, is you have to explain, OK, how is it actually produced in the first place? How do we, if it's completely cut off from the rest of physics except for gravity, how do we get enough of it in our universe to explain the observed abundance of dark matter? And that is where this CPT symmetric vacuum gives a possible answer to that. So if this guy is really in the CPT symmetric state, then you can calculate the difference between that vacuum and our late time vacuum and calculate the predicted abundance of the particle. It turns out to only depend on the mass of the particle. And so the first prediction of this approach is that if you want to get the right abundance, the mass has to be this value. Then you get the dark matter density matching the observed abundance. So in our interpretation, the measurement of the dark matter density today is just a measurement of one of the remaining coupling constants, previously undetermined coupling constants in the standard model, the mass of one of these right-handed neutrinos. Now, then there's some observable things you can do to test this prediction. So if this is right, then, okay, so in this theory, there's these three heavy neutrinos and there's three light neutrinos, and one of the three heavy guys is the dark matter. That's the idea. It turns out that if one of them is exactly stable, that same symmetry forces one of the three light guys that we actually observe to have zero mass. So that means you can predict the sum of the three light neutrino masses to be either 0.06 eV if the neutrinos are in the so-called normal hierarchy, or about double that if they're in the inverted hierarchy. And that's something that will be tested in the coming few years. In the coming few years, cosmologists are expecting to detect the sum of the three neutrino masses, and if it doesn't agree with one of these two values, then this model is ruled out. Further in the future, future neutrinoless double beta decay tests will be able to. So, again, if the dark matter neutrino is exactly stable, it ends up predicting that the rate of so-called neutrinoless double beta decay is at the right asymptote of this graph here. So it's some particular non-zero value. But which one it is, it depends on, again, whether the neutrinos are in this normal or inverted hierarchy. But it's, anyway, two particular values. So if you go and measure it and neither of those is right, again, this is ruled out.
Sorry, is that the 4.8 times 10 to the 8, is that the heaviest one or the lightest?
That is the lightest of the heavy three.
The lightest?
Yeah. The other three are even heavier to explain the seesaw mechanism.
They're even what?
Even heavier, probably. The other two account for the non-zero light neutrino masses via the seesaw mechanism. So you can kind of estimate their value from that, and from that you estimate their value to be something more like 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 13 GeV.
And so their occupation is just much less.
They are unstable. Only one of the right-handed neutrinos can be stable, yeah. So they just decay in the early universe, and their decay in the early universe is important because it is the only thing in this model that can explain the observed matter-antimatter asymmetry. They're responsible for so-called leptogenesis when they decay.
Wait a second. I thought you kept the right-handed neutrinos from decaying by insisting there was a symmetry under changing the sign of the field. You don't mean that for all of them?
No. So one of them has to be different for this to be true. I mean, only one of the right-handed neutrinos can be stable. Yes, exactly. I don't like it either. I agree with you. You know, however, it is an unexplained observed fact about the standard model that even though the charges of the three generations, the gauge charges are all the same, you know, in every generation of particles, the masses are very different from each other. So the top quark is very heavy, the up quark could still be zero mass, or could be very, very light. It's many orders of magnitude lighter. So there's, for some reason, there seems to be an approximate symmetry in every generation that makes one of the members of each particle, you know, in each particle type, charged leptons, neutral leptons, up type quarks, down type quarks, one of the three is always much lighter than the other ones. I don't know what that's about, but that's the same kind of, if they were exactly zero, that would be this same symmetry at work. So maybe it's not exactly zero. That's the other thing. It could just be, maybe they're not exactly stable. Maybe it's only an approximate symmetry in every generation, and these heavy neutrinos are not exactly stable. They're only approximately stable. All they really need to do is live much longer than the current age of the universe. But for all intents and purposes, for all practical purposes, that's the same for these arguments as being exactly stable. Yes, John.
There are three experiments that look for.
Yes.
Neutrino oscillate to the other three. Microphone, the stereo, and the prospect.
Yes.
They've rejected the Mathias functions, the light stereo neutrino. You have a question.
So that's right. So there are these three short distance neutrinos. All the long distance neutrino oscillation experiments seem to agree very well with this three right-handed neutrino paradigm for explaining the oscillations. And then there are these anomalies, the most pronounced one at mini Boone or micro Boone, among the short distance neutrino experiments, some of which claim results which seem to not be compatible with the three neutrino oscillation paradigm. And if those are right, then that's, that also rules this out. Yeah.
Also, there are three charged leptons in Utah. There's one or four charged leptons corresponding to the stereo neutrino.
I'm only using three right-handed neutrinos, just like three right-handed neutrinos along with everything else.
Right.
Oh, but if you needed a fourth one.
But there's a new U mu top corresponding to the charge E mu top.
Mm-hmm.
There's no fourth charge lipton.
Right.
So that doesn't mean to say it's wrong. It's just.
Yeah, but. There's no charged lepton, but there's also, in this picture, there's no fourth neutrino either. Okay, so I'm a little worried that I'm going to run out of time. So just to be a little bit quick, so the second prediction is that in this picture, the dark matter is completely cold. So if any observations say it's warm or it's fuzzy or it's axions, you know, that rules this out. And also, in brief, that the same mechanism, same idea basically predicts that there should be no primordial gravitational waves. In contradiction to, in disagree, you know, contrary to many models of inflation, for example.
What?
Briefly, it's because I didn't show you the formula for the Vogel-Yubov transformation for a fermion, but it depends on a positive power of the mass, and very similar calculation for a bosonic field also gives that it's proportional to a positive power of the mass. Since the graviton is massless, it doesn't get produced by this mechanism.
So are you going to explain primordial fluctuations in a non-inflationary mechanism?
Yes. Well, although it got, goodness knows it's going to be a whirlwind now. So let's continue with this sort of direction of trying to take seriously the symmetry of the extended spacetime. So here I've just taken the previous doubled cylinder and I've folded the bottom half up into the top half. So I've just laid them on top of each other. So now the symmetry relates the sort of outer sheet and inner sheet of this doubled cylinder. And so now suppose again I'm trying to take it seriously. So now I want the fields that live on this background to respect this symmetry. So let me look at solutions respecting this symmetry. The first thing you notice is that the solutions to all the field equations are analytic at the bang here. So one thing you can do is you can start at a point up here and just analytically follow them down around and then to the other inside corresponding point on the inner sheet. But on the other hand, you can use the assumed symmetry to just jump directly from the outer to the inner sheet, and compatibility between those two ends up forcing the fields to satisfy a mirror-like boundary condition at the bottom boundary here. So analyticity plus taking seriously the symmetry seems to force you to take the boundary to be a reflecting surface at which the fields satisfy Neumann boundary conditions. Well, that's good because that turns out to first of all, kill the primordial vector perturbations, a kind of possible perturbation in the metric that we don't see. And it also gives Neumann boundary conditions for the scalar perturbations, which, if you recall, on the sort of intro early slide I was explaining, that is what we do observe this synchronization of the scalar perturbations that does correspond to them satisfying a Neumann boundary condition at the Big Bang. So much for looking back. You might say, can you do the same argument around the top of the cylinder? Because here the scale factor at the future De Sitter boundary has a pole. You might say, okay, we can analytically continue around that too. Well, no, actually the field equations have an essential singularity up here at the top boundary here, so you cannot follow them over. So there's no analogous boundary condition imposed at the top. And so we think that's significant too, in the sense that it seems to give a nice explanation for the thermodynamic era of time. You know, an observed fact about the universe is that the stuff in the universe, its entropy goes up as you get further from the Big Bang. So we're saying that seems to follow from the fact that symmetry plus analyticity implies that there is a restrictive boundary condition at this boundary where everything is analytic, but not at this boundary. So down here, the fields start off near the bang, at the bang, in this very restricted part of phase space, but then ever since they've been wiggling into more generic parts of phase space, and nothing up here stops them from doing so. Okay, so much for the entropy of the stuff in the universe. So the next thing is I want to tell you about a result from this past fall about the gravitational entropy of the universe in this paper. Yes.
Like your
Neumann
condition into the opposite
space? Yes,
now,
exactly.
What about the amplitude? What says that?
Okay, so that's what, well, I'll be getting to that shortly. So the gravitational entropy of the universe, let me just sketch what we do in this paper. So here is the Friedmann equation for a general realistic universe that has just a radiation component, some radiation density that scales like a to the minus 4, some non-relativistic matter density, so it scales like a to the minus 3, a cosmological constant lambda, and then potentially positive or negative spatial curvature also. So that's sort of the general realistic universe, including all the stuff that we know is there. So the first thing we point out in this paper is that actually you can analytically solve this equation. I kind of think it should have been done earlier, and so if someone tells me they know of some reference where it's done earlier, we couldn't find it. So my impression is that for some reason people never cared about this enough to write it down. But so I think we wrote down the solution first. But in any case, it turns out to be kind of nice. It turns out to be really quite nice. It's given in terms of these special functions, very beautiful analytic functions called elliptic functions, that have this property that they're doubly periodic in the complex plane. So here I'm sort of showing a picture of the real and imaginary parts of the function plotted in the imaginary in the complex conformal time plane, and you see that it has a period. It's periodic both in the real time direction but also in the imaginary time direction, in particular. It kind of forms a tiling of the complex plane, the solution does. So if you take this little tile, this square-shaped tile, and keep repeating it, you get the solution. But another way to say that is that the solution really lives over that tile, and you can just identify the top and bottom and the left and right, and so you can think of the solution as really living over this torus. So the interesting thing about that, so the solution always has this nice property that it's always periodic in the imaginary time direction. But that's crying out to be given a thermodynamic interpretation. So there's famously Gibbons and Hawking noticed the same thing about the De Sitter solution in the 70s. They had this famous paper noticing that the De Sitter solution and the black hole solutions were all periodic in the imaginary time direction. And they used that to calculate the entropy of those solutions. So we just do the same thing here. So we just calculate the entropy of the solution by calculating the action. It turns out the thing that you're supposed to do is calculate the action around a period, and that gives the semi-classical approximation to the action. So we get a nice formula for the gravitational entropy of an FRW universe that way. Again, given in terms of elliptic functions. You can, it's an, this formula's not rather nice, and I refer you to the paper if you want to see the explicit formula. But so you can ask, when is it maximized? When is that expression for the entropy maximized? And it turns out that you know, as you change these various parameters, in other words, the amount of radiation, the amount of matter, the amount of lambda, the amount of curvature, and it turns out it's maximized for flat universes, meaning universes for which the curvature never becomes important. So at early times, let's say it's radiation dominated, and then at late times it's lambda dominated. At some point in the middle, it could have been that the curvature became important, but no, that would be disfavored entropically according to this formula. So the curvature is always negligible, which is how our universe seems to be. And then it also is maximum for when lambda is tiny and positive, which is this point already pointed out by Hawking. This was a, he wrote a famous paper back in the 80s arguing for this as a solution of the cosmological constant problem on the basis of the de Sitter solution, and this is a, basically just a generalization of his argument.
Not zero?
I was about to say, so that argument worked better when we thought the cosmological constant was zero. Now that it's merely very small but non-zero, it would, of course, would have be even better to have the formula. So no, it really predicts, what I'm saying is that the entropy formula, the entropy gets bigger and bigger as you go to lambda, as lambda goes to zero from above, but it's not the same from both directions. So so lambda negative is different. Unfortunately, its maximum value is at lambda equals zero, smaller than what we observe. But just to say quickly, I mean, okay. So just to say that you know, zero is. Seems closer to the current answer than which is very tiny.
Fine-tuning problem.
I think maybe we should let him finish, given that he doesn't.
Yeah, let him finish.
Okay. So then one thing to say is so far that was the formula with no perturbations, just for an FRW universe. Now you can add linear cosmological perturbations, scalar and tensor perturbations, which are basically linearized inhomogeneities and anisotropies. And then you find another interesting thing, which is that if those perturbations are required to satisfy mirror boundary conditions at the bang, as per the earlier arguments, then those also cost entropy. So those are also disfavored by this entropy. And so if the Big Bang is a mirror, the perturbations cost entropy. And so in summary, this gravitational entropy is largest for universes like ours that are homogeneous, isotropic, and spatially flat with a tiny positive cosmological constant. So we think it's striking that is the case. So maybe this formula for the entropy gives a natural measure on the space of universes, and we live in a universe that's favored by that measure. Okay, so very briefly, let me try to sketch in the final couple of minutes the argument about how to get the primordial power spectrum. So, in fact, how am I going to do this? Okay, so I want to say that in all the other, so symmetries can be global or local. Global symmetries can have anomalies, meaning that they fail at the quantum level. That's fine. We observe that in nature. Local symmetries, gauge symmetries, are thought to have to be anomaly-free, meaning that the anomalies have to actually cancel. So here is a picture that I've stolen from Peskin and Schroeder showing how all the different anomalies in the standard model do cancel. But what about local scale invariance or Weyl invariance? That's a symmetry that ever since the discovery of general relativity, various people have thought should be a symmetry too if general covariance is a symmetry. So is it a symmetry of the standard model? Well, if you ignore the Higgs for a second, which is weird, classically the rest of the standard model is Weyl invariant, but it has a famous quantum anomaly that this trace of the stress tensor ends up not being zero, but having two non-zero corrections to it. These corrections, you see, have to depend on the number of ordinary scalar fields, spin one-half fields, and vector fields, gauge fields, but the coefficients are all positive, so it seems like no cancellation is possible. What we point out in a paper from last year is that if you look at these extra, there's another type of scalar field you can have in four dimensions, which is also conformally invariant, which is has this action phi box squared phi. It's a dimensionless scalar field, unusual type of scalar field. It was first discussed by Fradkin and Seitlin in the context of conformal supergravity. And what they point out is that if you include these fields, you get, they make an extra contribution to the conformal anomaly and the vacuum energy, which is, comes in negatively for the conformal anomaly. And the interesting thing is that if there are 36 of these extra scalar fields, that all three, both of these vial anomalies and the vacuum energy promote all cancel. So it's this interesting numerological coincidence. If you add 36 of these modes to the scalar, to the standard model. So here I've said it. It only works because the number of fermions, three generations of fermions times 16 fermions per generation, is 48 fermions, is four times the number of vector fields. It turns out that that a gauge theory without that property can't have this cancellation happen. So it's a very curious fact, non-trivial cancellation. Two other interesting things about this, these weird new fields is that unlike ordinary scalar fields, these scalar fields automatically have a scale invariant two-point function. Because their action is different, their two-point correlation function is different. It's scale invariant. You don't have to put it into sitter to make it scale invariant like you do with an ordinary scalar field, which is why you normally do inflation. It's already scale invariant in the room here. It's scale invariant in any FRW universe. Interestingly, it also seems to have no local degrees of freedom. I don't have time to explain what I mean by that, but basically, it seems to not introduce any new actual detectable particles or forces. It's kind of an accounting trick that seems to fix the vacuum of the standard model and its coupling to gravity. And so most recently, we had a paper where we did a first attempt to calculate the induced curvature perturbations from this scalar, from scalar, including scalar fields of this sort. I refer you to the paper on the archive for the derivation of these formulas, but we get a formula for the spectral tilt, which just depends on a particular standard model parameter, the SU3 gauge coupling, and we get a formula for the amplitude of the primordial power spectrum, which also just depends on standard model parameters, but we only trust our calculation for modes which are outside the horizon, yet comparable, where the scale of the mode is comparable to the temperature of the background when the calculation is being done. In other words, we only trust our calculations for modes right outside the horizon at the Planck time. So this is our formula for the amplitude right outside the horizon, a co-moving mode that was right outside the horizon at the Planck time. But if you now take the standard model parameters run up to the Planck scale from this paper here, and you plug them into this formula, and then you use this formula to run this amplitude to the observed CMB scale, you get a predicted value for the scalar spectral index, which agrees strikingly well with the observed Planck value, and you get a predicted value for the scalar amplitude on Planck scales, which does not agree as well, but it does agree within 2 sigma with the observed value. So Planck observes 21 times 10 to the minus 10. We get about 13 plus or minus 4.5 at 1 sigma, so plus or minus 9 at 2 sigma. So anyway, it's a striking, it's interesting. It's interesting. So,
all right.
Yeah.
So, that's all we have time for.
Okay.
But we have a coffee break and we have a panel discussion later on.
Okay, thank you very much. Sorry for running over. Let me just say about the panel discussion later on. Unfortunately, I have to run to the airport right after my talk. I apologize about this. But if anyone has any questions about this, please feel free to email me. I'm sorry. And then I'll be joining.
Let's finish.